Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 5 of Chris Chambers Noir. We are starting 2026 off right with our panel of 4 authors who are celebrating what Chris says is it Southern Noir? Is it Hick Harboiled? Or is this the next revolutionary step of one of crime fiction's original forms? I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, incandescent.tv, Spotify, Apple, and iHeartRadio. So, Chris, take it away as you interview these 4 amazing authors: Scott Von Dowiak, Bobby Matthews, Wes Brown, and James D.F. Hanna. All right, Chris, over to you.
Thank you so much, Hope. And just a reminder, this is Chris Chambers Noir. We are on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and the Incandescent Radio Network. And I am just, I'm honored and I'm scared because but let me explain something, because we're going to do a deep dive and be very serious and academic very soon. Just 3 questions that we're going to do that with, that's going to just go out to the group. But, here's the thing. I mean, you guys are, almost a family, which is, can be said about our crime fiction genre in general in some respects. I could go down to see you guys on some dive bar on some numbered highway, not an interstate, not a real interstate, but a numbered state highway, that is, and see you guys drinking beer and having a good time. But you're also just exemplars of just an amazing kind of, craft explosion, and almost allegory for what is serious but not so serious. So what I'm going to do today is just mix the serious with the not serious. So just bear with me. It will work. Trust me when it's all edited. So here's the thing. I was at the Edgars twice when Henry Wise and Eli Craner won their Edgars. And people still looked at this kind of genre. I don't want to silo people, but this genre or subgenre rather, almost as a some new thing to kind of like disdain, or the flavor du jour, like almost like domestic suspense has been treated. And again, that's despite Eli winning. That's despite Henry winning. And we're going to go into that in a minute. But I want to show that duality here, just by just by pointing you guys out as almost as allegory. I mean, I met Wes in New Orleans at BoucherCon, and when I saw Wes, I said, you know what? If this guy had a black string tie and a white suit, I would be able to ask him about the herbs and spices and the chicken. But here is a man, who has melded a lot of Donald Westlake style, conflict over, who exactly is a protagonist. I mean, bad people who are protagonists, and is a technician and a craftsman, an attorney, an educator, prosecutor and defense counsel. So there's that duality, right there. And then I come to Scott, who, I got to tell you, when I first met Scott, I figured him that he would go up on one of them weird moon towers that you all have there in Austin and do his movie reviews and manuscripts from those things. I mean, I thought, is this guy like the grown-up version of Matthew McConaughey in Dazed and Confused? And again, I mean, this guy is, almost the second coming of Elmore Leonard mixed with Stuart Kaminsky. And again, another craftsman, another technician, when it comes to plot and character. So there's that duality. Then James D.F. Hanna, D.F. Stands for the fuck did that growth come from, on his chin. Again, taking something like, the atmosphere and the approach of something like Winter's Bone, and grafting that DNA on kind of the classic, noir PI you know, thrust that you have in the Henry Malone book. So, I mean, there's that duality. And then there's Bobby. I mean, I want to just clarify, he does not own a ball gag. He actually looks like a ball gag. Okay? So that's all I got for him. But no, but I mean, but you know, you think of somebody like Robert B. Parker and that kind of interplay of edge and humor and just kind of hard-hitting style and just taking a city like Birmingham and making it a character, not a setting, but a character, just like in our kind of noir subgenre, any city or any place becomes a character, not really a setting. So, you know, it is so, I'm so happy to be there. And I wanted to start with, I'm going to do three serious questions that I'm going to open it up. Now, when you're talking, feel free to interrupt the other guy, because I don't care. I'd like to see that. Because they probably, because, you know, everybody's going to have a good opinion except for Bobby here. So, you know, definitely. But I'm going to read you a quote from Eric Prewitt. And everybody knows Eric, you know, as another exemplar of this, you know, again, I don't like to silo people, but I mean of this kind of subgenre. And it's a serious question. I know Sirius and Eric don't necessarily track, but you know, bear with me here. I grew up on a farm, but read these pulp books about the city, New York, Chicago, LA. I never felt a true attachment until now. And where noir has moved to the country, like in Daniel Woodrell's Winter's Bone, which I mentioned, Frank Bill's Donnybrook, or Steve Weddle's Country Hardball. I felt a truer connection to my work when I felt allowed to, quote, write what I know, close quote, which was bad guys from the South doing bad things. There's nothing scarier than a Southerner with a chip on his shoulder. Now, there's a lot to unpack there, you know, on many different levels. So, you know, have at it. I mean, you know, is it a pretty simple, straightforward quote, or is there a lot to unpack there? Or do we need to go deeper? It is Eric, after all. We don't have to go that deep.
I mean,
but, you know, go ahead.
So I'll tell you this. I think that one of the things that you see right now is you see and you know, we have to look at the fact that we're all, you know, middle-aged white guys as guests on the program, right? And I mean, we look like Crime Writers Local 187, basically. You would see us at McDonald's having the cup of coffee, right? Here is the thing, though. You know, it's no secret that Sean Cosby is one of our really, really tight friends. And I love what Sean says. The South is for everybody. The South belongs to everybody. And I think that's one of the reasons that you see the explosion. It's because, you know, you say Wiley Cash also, you know, you have, you know, he's not everybody's favorite cup of tea, but Brian Panowich as well. A guy named Peter Ferris is writing Southern noir that can't get published in the U.S., but he is making waves over in France.
And we're going to talk about that, by the way. I mean, segue to the business later. But go ahead, Bob.
So the thing to me is, when I write about the South, I'm writing about things that I know. Specifically in Magic City Blues, I wanted to do what Robert B. Parker did for Boston and make the city a character. And, you know, in Birmingham, you have basically the birthplace of civil rights movement. You have a place that's been heavily redlined. You have a place that was known you know, in the last century, you remember that, Chris, as Bombingham.
Yeah.
You know, because of all of the violence there, right?
Yep.
So, hey, if I am going to write about this city or this region, I'm going to do it with all of the warts exposed and then that kind of wry sense of humor, hopefully, that I bring to it as well. So anyway, just thoughts there.
No, I mean that's a good intro. I mean, anybody want to jump on that or move in another direction on the question? Have at it.
I mean, that was sort of.
Go ahead.
That was the thing I always wanted to do when I started writing, because I grew up reading Parker, Ed McBain, Lawrence Block. Sarah Paretsky, Lauren Enstelman. I read a lot of PI novels. They were all set in big cities. And I never, but I only grew up in Eastern Kentucky and Southern West Virginia. So, I mean, like, when I went out of town, I went saw a place that actually had an escalator. That was a big fucking deal for me. Like, I thought those were just things, that was shit you saw in a movie. But when I started getting serious about writing, I realized I couldn't write. I thought you had to write a big city novel. I thought you had to, if you were going to write a big city, if you were going to write a crime novel, it had to be a big city novel. If you were going to write a rural novel, it had to be one of these, you know, heartbreaking, you know, tragic, Erskine Caldwell type thing.
You have to have an MFA from the University
exactly.
of Kentucky.
Exactly. Had to have an MFA and no one would ever fucking read it. It wasn't until, honestly, I got into my 40s and I started thinking about it. And I was like, what is the way that I can mesh these two things I want to do, which is write about what I know, which is rural West Virginia, Kentucky. But I want to, use all those tropes from PI novels and talk about the stuff that affected me, that it affects the lives when you live in an area like that. So, it is talking about the drug problem. It's talking about unemployment. When I wrote Midnight Lullaby in 2015, which is the first Malone novel, the antagonists in it are white supremacists. And I thought to myself, oh, man, it's 2015. Is white supremacy even still a thing now? And, I hate having been right on that. But it was just that opportunity, really, just to take all those things and write about them in a way that, made sense for me. But also acknowledging that the way I write, and Wes and I have talked about this, and Scott and I have talked about this, is, writing rural, but also we write very differently. I mean, Wes is writing, Wes's two books are in Kentucky also, but they're very different culturally, geographically different areas of Kentucky. Scott, wrote a road trip book, basically.
I was going to say, his is all over.
Yeah.
His most recent is all over.
I was going to... Like the Duke's Hazard broke bad.
I was going
to... Well, we're going to get to that, definitely. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Scott. You want to...
No, I was going to kind of, excuse my way out of this question, since I feel like I'm the odd man out on this one. Like these guys do that Southern noir, rural noir, whatever we're calling it. I mean, my first novel was set in Boston, Low Down Road, like they said, is a road trip. It does. I mean, it starts in Texas, but Texas isn't the South. I think it's its own thing. maybe I can get by on a technicality with that one. I don't know. But
he has to say that because he lives in Texas, and they'll go after him if we claim Texas is the South.
But Scott, again, it goes back to what I said before, where people were kind of scratching their heads when Eli and Henry won. I mean, would people say, look, it's the same. It's a road book. The Low Down, Low Down Road. I mean, it has this flavor. It's not in L.A., really. It's not in Brooklyn. It's not here with me at Pelicanos, on the streets of D.C. I mean, it's a road book. And then you have the kind of retro, almost Holloway House cover. And that might lead some people to think, well, it's kind of Southern noir adjacent. You see what I'm saying? I mean, do you see how people could make that connection?
You're saying that this is why I did not win the Edgar.
I voted for you.
I was about to point out that of all of us, Scott actually was nominated for the Edgar Award for Low Down Road.
He was.
It's a hell of a book, and he should have won.
It's a road trip, but it follows his characters whose origins are what they are. So wherever it goes, it's still a book about the people that he's writing about. It's not much of a secret, but the book that I'm hopefully will be out next, mine is set out west. And I'm a little bit concerned because my readers, such as they are accustomed to me writing about Kentucky, where I live. And the main character is a fish out of water out west. And I'm tempted at times, I think, should I make him from Kentucky just to have some link to what everyone's used to from me? But I may be the Scott, where were you raised?
Well,
I think I know, but I don't remember.
I grew up mainly in Maine. You know, I had been a Navy brat, so my first eight years were kind of just jumping around, but for the most part, Maine. And then I went to school in Boston. So that's, you know, that was the basis of my first novel. But, you know, I've been down here in Austin for, it'll be 30 years next month. So.
Wow. And he's still a Red Sox fan. He's still a Red Sox fan. That's too bad. But, you know, we won't hold that too much.
What Scott and I have in common is I'm not originally from Kentucky. And I moved here in 96 to go to law school, went to the University of Kentucky College of Law. But one of my biggest influences is I grew up 30 miles from where Elmore Leonard lived, where he was writing. And I read a lot of Elmore Leonard as a kid. And actually, it's funny that James D.F. Hanna is on here because I've referenced him a lot when I tell this story. I didn't even know I was writing crime. I wrote a book that I thought was a literary book that had this crime subplot, and a real late revision took out I essentially replaced the main plot with the subplot because my editor and some of my beta readers instructors said, this other part you're writing is better. Well, it was the sort of Southern noir crime part. And I didn't even really comprehend what had happened until James approached me to read at a noir at the bar and said, I was just so glad to find out there was another crime writer in Kentucky. I was like, oh, me, I'm a crime writer. Yeah. And I truly had to wrap my head around that. I hate that phrase. I hate that I used it. But anyway, I leaned into it because I thought that was the part that I did well. And that was what I wrote that people seemed to like the most and that I enjoyed writing. And I sort of fell into it, but I've been here since 96. So almost 30 years, not quite as long as Scott's been in Texas, but I practiced law here and was immersed in this. And this was what I knew how to write, but I came from that Leonard background, which funny enough, his most famous work is, you know, turned out to be Justified at this point, which is a Kentucky book that started in Florida. So anyway,
right.
We all, our paths to what we do are not all real consistent.
I am really glad though that I got to drag you down to our level.
I like this level.
Well, look, I mean, and you know, and I wasn't, and Scott, I wasn't trying to debate you or anything. I was just trying to say, look that there's, because I agree with, you know, what you were saying, it's just that there's a stream of thought out there that anything that isn't, you know, wired into a big city, you know, right there in the big city, it has some kind of and as a road book, you know, of any kind, gets wired into this, you know, Southern noir kind of a definition. And you know, and I've heard that before, you know, and it's not fair, but maybe that's a perception that a lot of people have. I mean, it's almost like anything that has a white housewife who's, you know, husband and lover are trying to kill her is domestic suspense. Well, yeah, it is, but there are definite, you know, exceptions to that rule, but there just seems to be a perception kind of a thing. And again, with your book cover, which was very retro and very cool, I think that probably did put some probably people over the edge and say, yeah, this is kind of Southern kind of, you know.
No, it definitely calls out
cracker crime or something like that, you know.
It definitely calls out, you know, Dukes of Hazzard, Smokey and the Bandit, that kind of stuff, you know, and that's intentional for sure.
Yeah.
But so, I think there's a lot of tendency to kind of, you know, to use your phrase, I think there's a lot of tendency to try and silo writers in. I mean, you know, if you look at what, you know, rural crime means. I mean, you know, we talk about Sean, think about Jordan Harper. Jordan Harper, She Rides Shotgun, which, you know, is a great rural crime novel, but it takes place in Southern California. It takes place, you know, kind of like dirty white boy, you know, drug dealers in California. But it is undeniably kind of a rural crime novel.
Right. Exactly.
So Lost King of California.
Yeah. Oh, which is a masterpiece.
And you have to think about, especially if we're going to bring up Jordan, I mean, you've got Daniel Woodrell right there from the, you know, also.
I was thinking him as well. Because, you know, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Bobby, and then Wes.
So, I mean, I was just thinking about it because I'm on a Woodrell kick now since he just passed. But, I mean, like, if you think about the death of Sweet Mister and that deep, deep darkness, which is, I think, you know, when we talk about Southern noir and really all of us who are here today, we write really dark shit. You know, I mean, we just do. It's where we go to. And I think that we probably all owe, whether we've read him or not, we probably all owe Woodrell a debt in our work, because in some ways it's like, oh, there is permission almost to go that dark, right? So, that was all I had.
The thing that I think about a lot, and it kind of feeds back into what we're talking about, is there's this conception that rural places are somewhat the same. And to a point, there's some truth to that in that they share similarities. Woodrell is writing about the Ozarks, but it might as well be Appalachia. They're not the same place. And culturally, they're very different. So when you read the books, one of the pleasures of reading these books are those little differences that different writers will find in their regions that will make their work richer. I actually went to an Appalachian writing event where they showed Winter's Bone. And they said, this isn't from Appalachia, but it is so similar. But, you know, you've got Jordan out in California writing rural stuff out there. Scott's characters are not necessarily from, you know, Tennessee, Georgia, but they're going to share a lot of similarities to James D.F. Hanna's characters and all of ours. And I think that the artistry, quite honestly, is one, you share those similarities that everyone can relate to. And then you highlight those differences and how things go down differently and how characters act differently. I write characters differently based on what county they live in Kentucky. And maybe the world doesn't see that, but in Kentucky, wow. I hear that from people that go, oh, you nailed Estill County. Oh, you nailed Jackson County. And it's little differences. So there's sort of this writing for a bigger audience and then also writing for your local audience. And you hope maybe it works for everybody.
Well, thanks, Wes. I mean, you just dropped the mic. We can stop now. you just went through my thesis.
Sorry.
Like that. That's all right. No. I'm going to go to some individual questions now. I mean, let me start with James. I was recalling a conversation that Wallace Strobe had with my mentor George Palikanos, and he was saying, how does one, and you know, you could talk about this with maybe Midnight Lullaby just briefly. How does one navigate, you know, you got characters that like know where the abyss is and they just are compelled to just jump in. And then you have characters that try to tiptoe around it. Maybe, you know, maybe they're looking for redemption. Maybe they're just not like that, but they're right there up on the edge. I mean, is that something you think in the Malone books that you play with and navigate?
Oh, completely. I mean, like, I think the redemption story, I think we're all, a lot of us, maybe not all of us, probably not Bobby, but a lot of us are trying to find a way to redeem ourselves. I mean, I think, you know, we're always trying to strive towards betterness, towards being better persons. I always say that the Malone books are kind of a Pinocchio story where, you know, someday, you know, Henry's going to be a real boy. He's going to grow up and actually be a real person at some point. And so that was really a theme that I really started because I also make Henry fight and push back against you know, maturing, against growing up, because he has a lot of those hallmarks of your classic PI. You know, he's, you know, an ex-cop. He's, you know, been shot. He's got an ex-wife. He's got a sidekick. He's in AA. It's all of those. But there's also a rampant lack of maturity and an unwillingness. And an unwillingness. Gee
whiz. Where does that come from?
I'm not saying he's based on me, but also like an unwillingness always to address the problems up front that he needs to work on. And so he's really, you know, his journey through those books, and by the time it reaches, you know, Because of the Night, he has matured a lot. He has, you know, kind of crept out of that self-pitying, you know, place that he was in for a lot of the stories, and found, you know, a greater sense of peace.
Okay. Let me move to Bobby. And, you know, James and I are probably in that more traditional, the current iteration of, you know, there was basically three legs to the stool originally. There was, you know, the PI, hard-boiled, the cozy, and the police procedural. But you guys you three, as we move away from me and James, have gone into like a whole new iteration of stuff. And yours is more of a, you know, an amateur, Bobby, you know, kind of a, I'm not going to say a sleuth, because that's not what he is. I mean, he's kind of like.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the writing.
Oh. There we go. Okay. You get, drop the mic again. Okay. This dude has gone to law school. All right. So, Bobby, again, you know, I mean, you're like your character, your protagonist is almost like a redneck Rocky Balboa without the boxing. I mean, he's a leg breaker.
Mm-hmm.
And when I come to Wes, I'm going to talk about, because your character and Wes's character are on a continuum. I mean, one of Wes's characters is an actual crime boss. The other, you know, yours is low on that, that side of the equation of, you know, the leg breaker, almost enforcer type of person. I mean, you know, is that somebody that you wanted to try to bring to light? What was that? What was Magic City Blues? I mean, why not just a PI or just somebody who just had stuff fall into their lap, was a regular person?
So I think it is one of those things where a regular person, or a person who has a certain kind of background, but who has never been an actual police officer or, you know, some kind of Leo, right? Law enforcement officers supposedly have to follow the rules. And I wanted to have a guy who was generally a guy who did whatever he had to do to keep soul and body together, right? So this is a guy who has very few rules. And because of that, I could have him do things like stuff a couple of guys into the trunk and leave them in long-term parking at Birmingham International Airport, you know, after disabling the trunk switch, the trunk latch, right? So,
sounds like you've done this before.
So, it's a little too well thought out, isn't it?
Right, isn't it?
So, no one asks Bobby for a ride to the airport.
Right. Honestly, I feel like this is more a reflection of having been stuffed in a trunk.
Well, I was going to say, this might be the other side of the coin here. It might be the other way around, right?
I'll never tell.
With a ball gag.
But I like the idea, like, so you go back to my debut, which is Living the Gimmick, right? And the guy there is also an amateur. And in many ways, Living the Gimmick is a bloodier book because its setting, and it's set in the 1980s world of pro wrestling, right? But if you read that book, I did something that I don't think that a lot of people do when you're writing a book about, you know, a crime novel about something that is like that carnival or circus background, right? I gave you a fair play mystery in it as right. well. If you put the, you know, and I didn't think I could do a fair play mystery with a cop because I, number one, I'm not interested enough in cops to write about them. And I'll sound like an asshole there, but that's never
been boring most of the time, you know.
But I mean, like, because cops don't interest me. What interests me is people who are trying to do their best to keep their lives together and will do that however they can. So that's really the answer there is I wanted a guy who was, you know, he lives in a no-tell motel where you get a drug dealer with every room. Right. And a team of 10 cockroaches to start out. Like living at Wes's house.
There you go. Look, you know, look, I'll let you get the last word, Wes. I'm going to move to Scott. So you, so let that percolate for a while. Let your response percolate on his ass. Okay. Now, Scott, you know, I'm going to go back to Lowdown Road again. I mean, I actually met Stuart Kaminsky and people like that down on Westlake a long time ago. I was lucky enough to do that through Gary Phillips, which was amazing. And, you know, when I see your book, I mean, it has that hard-hitting core to it, but you managed also to hold together, and, you know, and Wes had mentioned Elmore Leonard, hold together almost an ensemble of people and keep all those people juggled, you know, it's almost like Elmore Leonard injected. I mean, you almost basically out Tarantino doing Elmore Leonard, and that, you know, and I hate dropping those names like that, but I mean it's good for the audience to hear those connections. But you know, you're a technician when it comes to that. I mean, are you a pantser, as they say, or an outliner? Because I've seen elements of both there, and I guess you can't do what you do without intricately putting it in place at some point. But then it looks like you just take a lump of clay and just go at it. What's the secret, man? What's the secret sauce?
Definitely much more pantser. You know, I like to say with this one, because it is structured as a road trip, you know, I didn't have an outline. I just had a map, you know, and I knew the route, you know, I traced it out. Okay. The point A, Central Texas, they steal all this marijuana. They're taking it to Idaho for the Evel Knievel's Snake River Canyon jump. So what's the route? So I find it and I'm like, where did they go along the way? And, you know, obviously things have to happen to them. There are people chasing them, all those sorts of things. So that's as much of an outline as I had. And, you know, I just like surprising myself as I'm going along and finding out who the characters are, you know, the who you might originally think of as the villain. Well, not the main villain. The main villain is this insane sheriff, but one of the villains, this drug dealer that one of the main characters works for, you know, about a third of the way through, this tough guy, it's been out a couple of years. I can just give this away. So this really tough drug lord guy, black guy is, he's gay, and he stops along the way and he meets another man and they travel together. And I, that was not ever anything that was in my mind. But once he got to that point in the story, I thought, you know what? There's nothing I've put so far that would contradict this. And I think it would make it more interesting, you know, because I was drawing on tropes of 70s exploitation movies, and right. But I wanted to give them, you know, a twist for
do you
time,
think
as it were.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, is it a mark of honor, or is it something that people maybe misunderstand if they were to say that this is almost a pulp work too?
I totally agree it's pulp. I don't have any I don't cast any aspersions on that term at all. I mean, you know, Elmore Leonard, who was mentioned, is like, you know, probably my primary influence. Other people that, you know, I get compared to, like Donald Westlake, I had never started reading him until after I'd written these books because people kept bringing him up. So I was like, okay, I guess I can see that, the humorous aspect and stuff like that. But also, you know, I came from film criticism and writing movie reviews, and you know, I studied film, and so I think my influences are as much from, you know, cinema as they are from literature.
But you know, it's amazing how pulp and stuff like that, I mean, becomes the new literature in a way. And you know, that's why I wanted to ask you, because a lot of people, some people chafe and like, well, it's not really pulpy. But I'm glad that you embrace,
I embrace it.
Yeah, because that it's an art form. You know, it takes work to do that. Let me go down to Wes. Now, if you want to attack Bobby, please go ahead. He deserves it. But let me ask you a serious question first. You know, again, he's on one end of the spectrum or this continuum. Your protagonist is on the other. And we're talking about, you know, I mean, arguably not with him. And I'm talking about Bobby now, the bald dude over there. But as a quote, bad person, and I'm doing air quotes now, your protagonist is a bad person, let's just say. And your protagonist is in a, you know, the setting versus, you know, Birmingham and what Bobby's is doing to kind of just kind of make a living. I mean, you have a setting that's kind of, you know, very real. I mean, you have rural areas where something like weed is the cash crop now. I mean, there's no industry, there's no this, there's no that. It's kind of, you know, rust belt on steroids kind of a thing. And, you know, you could transport that to say, you know, Deanwood, you know, that in George Pelicanos is in my works, you know, where people don't have a lot of opportunity, and you have people who are kind of kingpins, who are running this kind of illicit stuff. I mean, but how do you navigate, you know, creating a character, you know, as a protagonist who's a quote, a bad person? I mean, is it as simple as, well, I got Godzilla, so I got to create a monster that's worse than Godzilla to make Godzilla look good? I mean, is that really the formula, or are you doing something a little more, you know, intricate?
In this case, there's sort of an origin story, and there literally is an origin story in that my first book, Hillbilly Hustle, was based on the true story of the pizza shop that my family co-owns and I help run. And James went to school at EKU. He knows Apollo Pizza's been around forever, and you used to be able to buy your weed there. And I wrote Hillbilly Hustle about a pizza shop in Richmond, Kentucky, where you could buy weed. And it's not true. It's all fictionalized, but that's based on our pizza shop in its old days. And the other thing that's real is the first chapter. I send my protagonist in that book to a card game in Jackson County, Kentucky, and that's where he meets Burl Spoon, who is the villain in Hillbilly Hustle. That was a real card game that I was invited to attend, and I was going to attend, and someone I knew grabbed me and said, don't go to that game, you're going to get cheated or you're going to get robbed. And I didn't go. And when I was trying to figure out how to connect this character in Hillbilly Hustle with that world, and how did he start dealing out of his shop, I sent him to that card game, and Burl Spoon ran this illegal card game where, you know, it's in the first chapter, so I'll tell it, in Hillbilly Hustle, he cleans up at the card game and finds out that he's either going to get robbed of everything or he's going to spend all the money on pot, which is what they sell, and that's how he gets put into business. So Hillbilly Hustle came out back pandemic time, and it did its thing. And the most popular character was Burl Spoon, the villain. And it was sort of my right. long way to debut. And I got nervous that I would get afraid and hit this sophomore slump where I wouldn't be able to write the next book. So before it came out, I started the second book, and I wanted to write a story about a crime boss who goes down. And for better or worse, marketing-wise, it may have actually been better for me with certain presses if I didn't carry over a character. But everybody loved Burl Spoon. People really liked him. And that's how I wound up with this character. He was a character who was not created for that book. And it's funny because they're both standalones, and people ask me which one should I read first. And it's really more fun to read his story,
right?
And then go back and see what were his origins, where did this guy come from? But I didn't have any great strategy there. I didn't. I wish I could say I was more thoughtful in creating Burl Spoon, but the original concept of They All Fall the Same is he was gonna go down in 3 days, because a lot of times these figures who seem so on top, their downfall is very fast and very violent. Well, I started to write it that way, and I was like, I can't do it in a day. Maybe I can do it in a week. And ultimately, there's a lot of things that intervene, and I didn't do that either, although sort of the first act is that week that I initially planned. Much like Scott, I don't plan a lot in advance. I just knew bad things were going to happen to this guy, and I didn't really know all what they were would be. But anyway, it evolved that way. But Burl Spoon, it's almost like you find love when you least look for it. I was not looking for a protagonist, and I found one in another book.
Wow. That's
the best I can put it.
No, hey,
I want to say something about this. I think one of the things that you did really, really well in that book, even though Burl is an asshole and he is clearly a bad guy, you did a really good job of showing him as wanting to be more than that and caring about his family, you know, caring about, and not just his, you know, his family in the book, but also the people who worked for him as family as well. I thought you did a really good job of showing how much he actually did care about his people, even though he could not say it or act in a way that made it, you know, kind of a caring that the other cast members could get with, right? They couldn't accept it. But I thought that that was really good, and showing how much those losses truly affected him. Like, he couldn't shake those things off. I thought it was really, really sharp.
Thank you. And I will say this. I've talked about this quite a bit. I was a criminal defense attorney for 24 years. I'm not at present, but I was for a very long time. I had my own practice, and I did public defender work some. Part of the inspiration, for lack of a better term, for this book and this character is how much exposure I had to people who did bad things, but who were ultimately had some redeeming qualities and were sort of likable. And my profession was essentially centered around trying to develop empathy for people who did things that are bad. You know, with juries, right, with prosecutors, with judges, I had to say this person did something wrong, but here's why they're human. And I found that most people who were in trouble often had people who really loved them and who they really loved, and they weren't all bad. And that interests me to write about that and expose more people to that. And you can see something else I tried to do is Clovis Begley is the antagonist, and he's Burl Spoon, but worse.
Right.
But even him, I tried to shoot through with some humanity so you can understand that. And, you know, as they say, he's the protagonist in his own story. He thinks he's okay, and there are people who think he's okay. I find that more interesting. I have more fun with this sort of, they're not even ambiguous. They're probably mostly bad, as said of Burl Spoon, but how they kind of operate in the world. I like to look at those characters.
Well, I mean, James and Scott, isn't it better just to make up these people rather than, you know, Wes thinking about his old clients, you know, you can just build, it's more fun just to build these people from the ground up, because, you know, and I'm just messing with you guys. But I mean, where do you, real quick, and I'm going to move to I'm going to combine the two last questions real quick. I mean, jump in on, you know, what Wes said. I mean, you know, he does have that, I'm going to say advantage in a way, because he's seen this human drama played out. I mean, it could even be somebody who's a single mom who got wasted and ran over somebody in an intersection. He might be defending, and you know she has a story. Is it an advantage for him or a disadvantage? I mean, for you, James, or for you, Scott. I mean, you know, just to create these people from the ground up, because isn't it harder to kind of deal with real people? You know, what do you guys think about that, James? What do you think? In any context, in the Henry Malone context or any context?
I'm not above stealing from the truth to build a story, to create a story. Midnight Lullaby, and She Talks to Angels, which is the third Malone book, were both kind of based on actual crimes that took place in southern West Virginia, in the Charleston area when I lived there. And so I certainly, and if I'm honest, the white supremacist antagonist, in Midnight Lullaby is straight up every female anchor on Fox News.
You almost took this into a really terrible.
Right.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah.
Go ahead, James.
Yeah. Go ahead. No.
Oh, you want to go?
Yeah.
No, go ahead, James, and then.
No,
Scott.
I was just going to say that I also, you know, I use true events in my stuff regularly, you know, but I. Just as a jumping off point that I in Charles Gate Confidential, I used a real art heist. I just moved it, 40 years in time to suit my own purposes. And, and then in Lowdown, I had the Snake River thing. Evel Knievel he doesn't ever actually appear as a character, but he's kind of hovering over the proceedings a bit. And, my next book, I can't say much about, but it is another, it's based on true events. And, but, you know, I also, you can take characteristics of people you know and add them to you may not know an evil sheriff in real life, but you can take certain characteristics from people you know and give them to him.
Right.
And of course, I've seen a lot of movies and that helps too.
Oh, go ahead, Bobby. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I got a question for Scott. I know the subject matter for the next book, right? But my question to you is like stuff like that when you're using like a real life jumping off point, does that affect you for research or like does the research for that affect you doing kind of the pantsing? Does it affect you at all?
Well, you hope that stuff is going to come up during the research that you didn't think of, and then you use it, and you're like, oh, this is great. I can, I wouldn't have even thought of this, but, I can use this for something. So, you need all the help you can get that isn't AI. So, yeah.
Well, I'm going to combine these two questions, really. I'm going to do my best. But I mean, in terms of the business, I mean, I remember at one point, noir itself was kind of, I wouldn't say on the ropes, but you had a resurgence that really kind of was jump-started by, like Thug Lit with Todd Robinson. A lot of people got their start, writing the short stories there and got the nice t-shirts and everything. There seems to be... still a resistance, still, even though we are, as I like to say, one of, the latest iteration of one of those three prongs of the legs of the stool, and something in the business that's really tending towards, I mentioned, domestic suspense. I mentioned a lot of times, this over indulgence to create stuff that's my favorite words from these people, twisty and propulsive, to the point where you're just sitting down and creating twists and propulsiveness rather than characters and stories. And do you think, and I'm combining the last question, do you think that a lot of that is because we are all very different people here in this in these squares, but we all have dicks. Well, maybe not Bobby, but we all have dicks. And is that a problem? Does that hold us back in this business? Because we're talking about noir, and it doesn't matter whether it's whatever. it just does not hold water for a segment of the readers out there, the big segment that want to see the twisty, propulsive thing where a woman like them, who looks like them, solves the mystery of whether it's her husband or her lover trying to kill them. I mean, you know, and I'm throwing that out there because, I mean, is that an issue out there? Because you see it with the readers. And then there are not that many of our sister writers. There are a lot who are, but not as many who are taking up the banner of noir as you are with, say, domestic suspense and those kinds of thrillers. Have at it. What do you guys think?
I mean, it's like, you know, I can only sing in the key that I can sing in. You know what I mean? And I do want to answer the question. I do have a dick. I'm actually talking to four. So, anyway. Sorry, Scott got caught by friendly fire there. Love
you. You could have said three.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I should have said three.
You were.
Anyway.
You know, I hope the Rose Bowl. I hope you just get killed. Just killed.
So
on national television, please, here, God, the thing, please. Though,
like, and I really do think that it's like this for almost all of us. We have to pursue the shit that we're interested in. We have to, because otherwise we're not writing honest books, right? We're
right.
Like, I'm not going to try to try a twisty, propulsive thriller for the cash grab, because I think that, you know, readers can tell when it's fake. And I think that that's one of the good things about all of us here is we don't write fake shit. We don't write fake shit. We write the stuff that interests us, and we hope that other people.
But Bobby, let me stop you. But how do we get our sister writers more interested in doing the material and women readers more interested in buying and reading our stuff, though?
I mean, I will say that I think that, like, Alex Kenna does a little bit more noir.
Right.
I think Mindy Carlson's trying to break that a little bit. KT Nguyen, I think, is trying to push a little bit that way, although she...
Yeah, she's pushing the envelope away from domestic suspense. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean... How do we get other people to follow that? I'm not sure that we should, because
enough.
I mean, again, what we write, like here's the thing: like, Scott's going to write the shit that interests him, and a lot of the stuff that interests him is crazy 1970s shit, which is awesome because the 70s were that decade that feels like so many things could actually happen. Like, Evel Knievel actually could jump Snake Canyon, right? Actually, yeah. He could do it. We had just landed on the moon the decade before. You know, the 70s were open, and I think that Scott's got a lot of fertile field there. And Wes is doing, you know, you talk about Kentucky noir. He is doing that, but he is doing, like, really King Lear type shit. He's doing the fall of huge, larger than life, almost personalities with these kings. James DF. Usually it's DTN, but the thing that he is doing, though, and he and I probably are closer in the scope of what we actually do. We both robbed the corpse of Robert B. Parker, and. Took everything that the estate had not nailed down, right? But we also
have you now quoted there. Okay,
I have said that Parker and Westlake and Leonard and Block are my Mount Rushmore, right?
Right.
So it really, really hurts me to hear Vondoviak being compared to Westlake. That one hurts me. That
it's kind of true, though.
That was the most painful thing for the whole thing.
Can I jump on something?
Go ahead.
I felt like I talked long a minute ago, and I don't want to talk too long, so I'll try and keep it brief. But I feel like this idea of propulsion and twists is getting sort of a gender thing to it. And I don't know if I feel like that's fair. I think there's a couple things at play here. One, I think it's a man problem in that men don't read women enough. And women will read men.
Yep.
Are much more generous about reading men. And certainly I think if you write all your characters well-rounded, the men and the women, it helps a lot to get that. But I don't think that's really so much a gender thing, at least. You know, a lot of women read crime, a lot of women read thrillers. If you do a good job, they'll read you. It's that men, for whatever reason, don't read women enough and should. And the other thing I would say is it's not, you know, I have ADHD. So when you talk about propulsion and twists and that sort of thing, I love that stuff. I like when there's a lot of that happening. I think the bigger issue is men just don't read in the numbers that women read.
Okay.
And so I think that colors this too, is we don't do a good enough job drawing the quantity of male readers in. So I don't know if this is so much of a gendered conversation. I think on both points, it's a little bit the fault of men that we're talking about it at all.
Right. Okay, no, fair point. Fair point.
Scott, James,
go ahead.
When you look at New York Times bestsellers lists, for example, back in the 70s and 80s, and you had, writers like Robert B. Parker, would routinely be, you would have noir writers, PI writers, hard-boiled writers, make, the New York Times bestsellers.
Right.
They were popular writers. Movies were being made from Ed McBain novels. Stuff was getting adapted for television. A lot of this is just like Wes said, men don't read fiction. Like men, they've done studies, they've done reports, and it's like men read books about business and sports. A lot of men only want to read something that they think is going to be, useful or beneficial, and they don't see fiction as being beneficial.
Right, right.
And so it really kind of is really the bigger thing is, how do we get more men to read, read fiction? Because honestly, also, two of the best writers of noir are female writers, and that's Christa Faust and Megan Abbott.
Right. And I interviewed Christa in episode 3. Yeah. No, I just wanted to get your feelings on this. I mean, I was because it's something that's, it's an interesting, I don't want to use that word, twist on a lot of my theses about noir. And and given the, the makeup of the panel, I just wanted to see, what you guys thought about that, because it's just because you're right. When you look at it, it's almost kind of Trumpian, because you look at a slice of what's going on, and it's like, oh my God, I'm a white man, life is so terrible. But when you look at a continuum, it's like, no, it's not. And you're right, Jim. I mean, James. I mean, the bestsellers for a long time in this kind of siloed thing. And, even
Mickey Spillane was one of the best-selling authors in the world for like 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
That was not because women were reading my
character. Right. I mean, we're probably to this day, on the flip side, probably suffering from what he did.
That's a little bit what I was thinking about is, I was kind of later to crime fiction than some of these other guys. And so I've listened to Bobby and James talk about old crime fiction to the point that I glaze over and stop listening, because they know about a lot that I don't know anything about. But I do try to
people do that when Bobby and I talk, Wes. It's fine.
I try to go.
Scott is nodding. Over there.
I try to go back and
try to avoid the crossfire.
Yeah. I try to read sort of these seminal works and these masters, and the treatment of the female characters is not great very often. And it's a flaw in those books, but I think there is an element of too, is that why women are less likely to read that particular style? Because in the past, they knew sort of how those books treated women. And that is a reason why there's maybe a lack of interest in certain types of stories.
Right. I mean, Scott, you want
to... You know, they nailed it with the fact that dudes don't read. But, you know, and like Wes said, I mean, I remember a reading I did once at a bookstore, and the only people who, you know, bought Low Down Road were women, and they, and I had, you know, at BoucherCon, I'll have, you know, women coming up to me and telling me they loved it. So it's not, you know, I it's not toxic to them at all. So I think that it really is on the, I mean, and I don't have a solution for how we get guys to read. I mean, that's, but
you can't,
you know, I mean, Sean makes the bestseller list, so it is possible. Right. Stuff can happen.
Go ahead.
I do want to jump on that too. Is like as soon as you said that, I was thinking about John D. McDonald and the Travis McGee series.
Right.
Right. You feel free to glaze over on this one. Well, those books are fantastic pieces of noir. However, they are absolutely flawed from a modern sense because of their treatment of women. The women in the McGee books and in some of the Parker novels, and not Robert B., but in some of Donald Westlake / Richard Stark's Parker novels, the women are either there to die or to get laid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and you see that.
And often Chester both.
Yeah, often both. That's true.
Yeah, absolutely. When you look at some of Chester Himes' book,
that order, hopefully.
Right.
Although we were talking about Henry earlier.
Henry Wise, or
There's a famous scene anyway.
But I was going to say, and I'm going to talk about Henry in 2 seconds, and we're going to wrap up, but. I mean, Chester Himes' books, I mean, if you look at the police procedural ones with Coffinhead Johnson and Gravedigger Jones, I mean, they are just awful to their own people. I mean, and I'm not talking about just beating up a snitch. I mean, just terrible. But just, we're going to wrap up here, but I just wanted to say, you guys were all at BoucherCon. Did anybody get a taste of Henry's moonshine? You did, yeah. I have to tell you, that had to be the most surreal moment in my life. Because here's why: because we're in New Orleans, we're like two steps from the French Quarter, but we're in a hotel bar, drinking moonshine. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are like 30 bars within walking distance where you can just chill, have a great time, or just go wild. And we're in a hotel bar drinking moonshine. I mean, that says something about us. I mean, are we dysfunctional or are we weird? I mean, what is the story?
I think you're kind of answering your own question there, Chris.
do you know?
His own answer.
Do you know that Henry did not fly because from Virginia to New Orleans, he did not fly because he couldn't bring his moonshine.
Yeah.
So I mean, he drove.
It's rocket fuel. Yeah, yeah. I mean, could you imagine, you know, look, God forbid, but I mean, you know, award-winning author blows a plane in fireball of grain alcohol. I mean, mm-hmm. That would be a great plot. Yeah. But I mean, just to finish up, I mean, I love that because it shows the connection, in, you know, that we all have, and I want to end this on a story that Sean Cosby can corroborate. It takes place at a Edgar's, at a MWA Edgar's, and Sean and I think this Scott might have been there. Sean and I are talking to a Pulitzer Prize winning author, an African American gentleman with dreadlocks. I met him actually when he was a little kid, and this guy is sitting there telling Sean, he's marveling at how nice everybody is, that everybody is so cool and down to earth and wonderful. And I won't attribute this to me or Sean. I'm not going to say anything because it's a public, you know, kind of a thing. But the statement was made to him, and it went like this. You all, and he means, or maybe with me, I don't know, literary big shot, you know, writers are, we as crime writers are wonderful people who write about terrible things. You all are terrible people who write about wonderful things. And this person just kind of went, just kind of glazed over. And I just remember Sean's smile and my smile as he just went crazy, this guy. Now, the punchline there, and I have a picture to this effect, I don't know if Scott saw this, was the guy then wet his index finger and gave me a wet willy in the ear. And that kind of turned Sean off quite a bit. Because you could hear the saliva kind of, you know, just this, not in my ear, but just everybody else could hear it. So wait, I do have a picture. I'll send it to you. But it's a testament to what we do and we come up with these stories. And, you know, and again, this Southern noir, whatever you want to call it at this point, is the next level of that. And I want to, you know, thank you guys for showing us and the audience, everything that entails, you know. So, you know, again, we're on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Incandescent Radio Network. Bobby Matthews, Scott Vandoviak, James D.F. Hanna, Wes Brown, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here on Chris Chambers Noir. We started off 2026 absolutely right with this fantastic little racy conversation with these four Southern noir writers. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, very proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, incandescent.tv, Spotify, iHeart, and Apple Podcasts. We will see you next month, Chris Chambers Noir, Episode 6. You'll be surprised and love our next guest. Happy 2026 to everyone.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, we'll see you.
Happy New Year, y'all.
Next month. Thank you.